Let's have the Judiciary Committee come to order. It is 1:36 on the afternoon of Friday, March the 12th, my 22nd wedding anniversary. My sister reminded me this morning.
Hey, that's great.
Bless her soul. And we are the Judiciary Committee. We have a quorum to conduct business. Senator McGuire is here, Senator Coghill, Senator Wolakowski, myself, Senator French. We've got three bills on our agenda today, and so let's go ahead and start with SB 92, the National Popular Vote Bill. We have had a hearing on the bill. We took a fair amount of public testimony. I think we have one person that we've got a few more people now signed up to testify. I don't intend to hear from people who've already testified, so I'm going to assume, with perhaps one exception, that the four people we have signed up to testify have not testified in the past. So let's go ahead and do that. Let's turn to, first of all, Grant Hunter should be on the line. Mr. Hunter, are you there?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, we can, Mr. Hunter. Go ahead and, for the record, state your name, your affiliation, if any, and you'll have 3 minutes to tell the committee what you think about SB 92.
My name is Grant W. Hunter. I'm a self-employed attorney. I am also a member of the Republican State Central Committee. However, I'm testifying on behalf of myself today, not on behalf of the State Central Committee.
We understand. Thank you, Mr. Hunter. Please go ahead.
I'm opposed to this bill because I can think of no justification whatsoever why persons who are not entitled to vote in Alaska elections should be allowed to decide how Alaska casts her electoral votes in presidential elections. Secondly, I do not think it proper for one legislature to give away the right of future electorates in future elections to decide how those electoral votes shall be used. Such a decision in each election must be made by a vote of the people entitled to vote in Alaska elections, subject to the electoral procedures provided by law in Alaska. The people of the lower 48 have enough power over Alaska. There's no reason whatsoever that their vote should be allowed to decide how we vote in presidential elections. I am familiar with the argument about, the majority of the people should elect the president. Well, Article 2 and Amendment 12 of the United States Constitution say otherwise. They provide for the electoral votes to choose the president and the vice president. And it has always been the practice in every state since 1860 that the popular vote in a given state determines how the electors shall be chosen. Now, there are two states, I believe, Nebraska and Maine, where they break up a couple of them by congressional district, but in practice, I believe it never would have made a difference in those states if you look at the vote totals for the elections. Now, some people see the national popular vote as a way to advance the cause of minorities, in particular, the black and the Jewish population. Well, the cold hard fact of the matter is this: if we had a national popular vote, the political influence of blacks and Jews at the presidential level would be diluted. As it is now, a lot of the political clout which blacks and Jews have in our national presidential election comes from the fact that their votes are necessary to get the electoral vote in key states. However, once you shift to a popular vote, it's not necessary to carry any given state to win a presidential election. Remember, we're in the age of targeted computerized marketing. You could easily devise a strategy to get an artificial majority in a presidential election that would ignore blacks and Jews. For example, you could very easily run a presidential campaign targeted on whites, Asians, and Hispanics. And I couldn't dismiss the possibility that we would have a candidate in some future election if we went to national popular vote that would say, if I'm elected, here's what it would be. I will stop spending the blood and treasure of the people for programs that basically are designed to cater to the black and Jewish populations. I know this sounds a little far-fetched now, but as President Kennedy observed when he was a senator, when the idea of a popular vote for president was discussed in the 1950s, we can't be certain what would happen if we disrupt our system, how the dynamics would change. And I'd point out that our presidential electoral system has generally worked fairly well. I only know, can recall of two occasions when the national popular vote was also not the same as the electoral vote. One was in 1860. And that one, there were four candidates running, so nobody was going to get a majority given the contentious issues of the day. Now, the other one that everybody always likes to bring up was the 2000 election. And I know there were a couple people in the back of the room there thinking, because I've talked to a couple of you on this subject, I'm sure, oh, Gore would have won if we'd gone by the popular vote. But as I recall, a man who served in the Clinton administration pointed out, I believe he was the man who was President Clinton's Solicitor General, we don't know, no, that's not true, because the campaign would have been run differently. And then again, I come back to this fundamental point. The legislature does not have the right to give away the votes of Alaskans to vote in future elections. I think this may very well be a violation of the Voting Rights Act. Now, as for the benefits of the Electoral College, I believe each member of the Alaska State Senate has received a written submission from me via the email, but Ms. Tara Ross, the author of Enlightened Democracy, The Case for the Electoral College, published in 2004, it's available online from Barnes and Noble. As pointed out that
Mr. Hunter, you've gone well over 3 minutes. If you could wrap up, please.
You have no business giving away the vote of Alaskans to vote how they will cast their electoral votes in future elections.
Thank you. Let's turn now to Pat Stidman. Pat Stidman, are you on the line?
Yes, I'm here.
Mr. Stidman, go ahead and give us your name, your affiliation, if any, and please keep your remarks confined to 3 minutes.
Yeah, I'll try not to be long-winded. sorry about that. I don't have any affiliation. I'm just a voter, and I like to first of all, I'm in favor of the Senate Bill 92. As our esteemed previous speaker pointed out, things have been happening throughout our democracy for many, many years, and our democracy is an emerging and a growing democracy. It's continually transforming itself and becoming more available to each and every citizen. I believe that we have reached a time in our history where we have gotten to the point where it's necessary to protect a pure democracy and the rights of each individual to have their one individual vote counted. There have been times in our history when the will of the people has been overridden because of the electoral college system. I think it's time that we continue to evolve. I think we've gotten to that point in our maturing American experiment that it's time to move on and to remember what happened in South Africa when none of the citizens could vote. Every citizen's right to vote should be protected. So I urge you, I support the Senate Bill 92. I urge you guys to pass it, and let's get on with democracy. And I think my 3 minutes are up.
Mr. Stidman, thank you. Next up is Ralph Stevenson. Ralph Stevenson, are you there?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, good afternoon. This is Ralph Stevenson. I'm calling in on my own behalf from Anchorage, and I'm calling in today in support of SB 92. Thank you for taking the time.
You're welcome. Is there more you'd like to add?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. This is a very simple issue to me. The national popular vote goes to the core of our basic founding as a country, meaning one vote for one person. There was a time, as our country was young, and history had shown, where rural areas and rural communities needed assistance in having a balance with the population centers when it comes to voting. That's not the case today. The national popular vote is very simple. It will ensure one thing and one thing only, and that is that every voter will be important, as every vote will be equal. There's no more chances, whether you argue this has happened before or not, there would never be another chance of electing a president who doesn't reflect the most votes cast by the populace. Furthermore, in a time in this country where there is such a level of hyper-partisanship, this legislation, this proposal, enjoys a strong spectrum of bipartisan support. Former U.S. Senator Jake Dorn from Utah, a Republican, and Congressman Tom Downey from New York, a Democrat, as well as legislators and legislatures from across the country on both sides of the aisle are supporting this measure. I think it's only right that Alaska take up this measure, and I'm glad that you have, and I do hope that Senate Bill 92 gets passed. I thank you for your time today.
Mr. Stevenson, thank you. Next up is Jeff Worthy. Mr. Worthy, are you there?
Hello. Yes, can you hear me?
We sure can. Go ahead and state your name and affiliation, if any, and go ahead and give us your testimony.
My name is Jeff Worthy. I'm just an independent voter in Anchorage, and I was just calling to voice my support for national popular vote. I think, quite simply, electoral vote and the Electoral College should mirror the vote of the national election run for president. I'm for Senate Bill 92, and I'd like to thank the chairperson and all the esteemed senators for taking time to look at this issue, and I hope you do vote for it, because as a voting person in Anchorage, I am 100% for this thing, and I'd like to thank you for your time, and I'll listen off the air.
Mr. Worthy, thank you for being succinct. I appreciate that. That brings us to the end of the folks signed up to testify. Barry Fathom is on the line, but Mr. Fathom has testified in the past, unless any members of the committee have questions for him. Senator Wilikowski, go ahead.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple questions. Mr. Fathom, I know you've, this is something that you've done a lot of research on, and can you just real briefly talk about how, you know, I've heard concerns from people that say this doesn't help small states like Alaska, and why are we giving away our 3 electoral votes? And I'm just interested to hear your opinion on that.
Good afternoon, and thank you very much for letting me respond to the question by phone today. I appreciated the chance to be in Juneau a couple weeks ago. You know, thank you for asking about the small state issue. You know, the issue here is that the reason Alaska receives no attention in a presidential election has nothing to do with the fact that it is small. The reason that Alaska and most of the other small states receive no attention is that you are not a battleground state. You're not closely divided. So the purpose of the national popular vote proposal is to make a vote in Alaska as valuable as a vote in a closely divided state like Ohio and New Hampshire. So as I think I mentioned last time I testified, there are 13 small states, 6 are red, 6 are blue, so the only battleground small state is tiny New Hampshire. So in the 2008 election, tiny New Hampshire received 12 of the 300 post-convention visits from the 2008 candidate, where the 12 other non-competitive small states, like Alaska, received virtually no attention at all. And with your permission, let me just give you one other statistic that I think really demonstrates why this proposal will benefit the small states so much. The 12 smallest states non-battleground states, including Alaska, have a combined population of about 11.5 million voters. Coincidentally, Ohio has exactly that same number, 11.4 million people. The 12 small states have 40 electoral votes among them. Ohio has 20 electoral votes. But as you would expect, in the 2008 election, Ohio received 62 of those 300 post-convention visits, whereas the 12 small states, including Alaska, received only 2 visits. So in summary, the national popular vote bill would make a vote cast in Alaska, a small state, just as important as that as a vote cast in Ohio.
Mr. Fadum, thank you.
Thank you, Senator.
Is there anyone else online you'd like to testify about SB 92? Anyone else here in the room that would like to testify? Hearing and seeing none, we will close public testimony. This is the bill's second hearing. Do any committee members have any proposed amendments to the bill? Don't hear or see any. Committee discussion and motion. Senator Wilkowski.
Mr. Chair, I would move that the committee move SB 92 out of committee onto the next committee referral with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal note.
Is there objection?
I'll object, Mr. Chairman.
You want to speak to your objection, Mr. Coghill?
Thank you. I've tried to get my thought process in tune with this. I've tried to stay open as much as I can, and have finally come to the conclusion that I really believe that this would not be the right thing to do. I think the fact that we're a republic should stay firmly within our focus, and I think this kind of takes Alaska and bends us into a more populist, democratic focus, and I would rather have us stay within a republic democratic focus. So just that's a structural issue. I've tried to look at these statistical issues as best I could and come to the conclusion that, in fact, I see us diminishing our vote capacity almost by half. And I'm not a statistician, so I think, but under the electoral vote, we have at about a 56% vote grade, and under the popular vote, about 0.23%. So I don't see where we gain, and I see where we probably lose more of the 10th Amendment issues that protect us as a nation of states. The winner-take-all issue in a state was one that caused me some time to stop and think about it. But the reality is, under this compact, we're still under the winner-take-all. It's just that we surrender our vote to somebody else who really has the right to overpower us and may, in fact, overrule the state's popular vote. So the way we assign our electoral votes is a popular vote to Alaskans that assign the winner-take-all. To me, the winner-take-all on this compact would be no different. So I don't see where we gain anything there. So I'm going to stick with what I think is probably the best Federalist approach, and that is a nation of states. We're certainly a nation of people, but even in the preamble of the Constitution, it's we the people of the United States. And so I want to keep it that way. And so I'm going to vote no on this bill.
Thank you, Senator Coghill. Other committee discussion? Senator Wilkowski.
Well, and you know, if I had to press the up or down vote today on whether or not I support or don't support the bill, I don't know how I'd vote, quite honestly. I think there's been great arguments on both sides. I think it's really healthy for our democracy, but I'm not making a motion to approve the bill. I'm making a motion to move the bill out of committee onto the floor, onto the next committee for further debate. So I think that's a democratic way to proceed with this bill. I'm going to no-rec this bill, Mr. Chairman, and reserve my right to decide how I'm going to vote on it. But I do think the better course of action is to simply move it on and let the full body take it up if that is the desire.
The clerk would call the roll, please.
Senator Coghill.
No.
Senator Wilkowski.
Yes.
Senator McGuire.
Yes.
Yes.
3 yeas, 1 nay.
On a vote of 3-1, the bill moved from committee. Let's take a brief at ease to do the paperwork. We're back on the record here in snowy Juneau. And next up is Senate Bill 239. I see we have the sponsor here and his able staff. Senator Meyer, welcome to the Judiciary Committee. Please come forward. We'll turn it over to you now to make a presentation about your bill.
Do you want a motion, Mr. Chairman, to adopt this CF?
Senator McGuire,
be happy
you.
To
yes.
make it.
Yes, please.
So, Mr. Chairman, I'd move and ask that we adopt /S, the work draft for the committee substitute for Senate Bill number 239.
Is there objection? Hearing and seeing none, the /S is the working document before the committee. Senator Meyer.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the Judiciary Committee. For the record, my name is Senator Meyer, and I represent South Anchorage, Senate District O. And I appreciate you hearing Senate Bill 239, which, as was mentioned, relates to ignition interlock devices. And 2 years ago, we worked hard on getting this passed, this legislation pertaining to ignition interlock devices as part of sentencing for driving under the influence of alcohol. The legislation became law, and for over a year now, it's been in place, and some of the judges have been using it as part of the DUI sentencing. However, what we found out was that this effective tool to keep people who have been drinking off the streets has not been used as often as maybe we had hoped or anticipated. In fact, in 2009, 3,513 court orders requiring ignition interlock device, but only 218 were actually used in these.
Give me those numbers again, Senator Meyer. I don't mean to interrupt you, but that one.
Yeah, it's fine. 3,513 court orders requiring the ignition interlock device, but only 218 were actually
installed.
Yeah, actually installed.
Thank
yep.
you very much.
Yes, and this is something that should concern all of us because it has been proven that the ignition interlock does work, does prevent people who have been drinking from starting the car and driving, which is what we all want. As you know, we have lots of laws and programs to try to stop drunk drivers, but this one actually works because you can't start your car. This bill specifies a time period in which the ignition interlock device would be needed to operate your car. These time periods are kind of stair-step. Again, they go along with the sentencing of the various offenses. So for just first time, it's 6 months, and then it goes on up with the number of times you've been convicted for DWI. This bill would also list as an ignition interlock device as a condition of sentencing that may not be suspended. I think that was a mistake we had made previously, is that we had the word shall instead of may. No, I'm sorry, we had the word may instead of shall. So some of the judges, you know, weren't using that the ignition interlock as we had hoped. So with that, Mr. Chairman, we do have the Department of Law here as well, or online, to answer any questions, and I have my trusty staff. And we have been working on this bill for a while, and I think we have it in a position now that hopefully is suitable to the committee.
Thank you, Senator Meyer. Questions for the bill sponsor, Senator Coghill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The numbers are surprising, the amount of convictions versus the amount of devices, 239, I think you said. So if we mandate this, is there going to be the capacity for people who are contractors or able to get the devices in the interlock circumstances? I mean, is there going to well, I'll just leave it there, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'll ask my trusty staff to join me. She's been doing more research on this. But I know there's at least two vendors that sell these devices or lease the devices, and there may be more now. And at the time we had passed the bill, we had asked them that question. And you know, we knew approximately how many DWIs we have each year. And, yeah, they said that there wouldn't be a problem meeting the need.
Welcome.
For the record, my name is Christine Mayer-Segan, staffer to Senator Kevin Meyer. Through the chair, Senator Coghill, that's an excellent question, asking about the capacity of whether or not there would be enough vendors or providers to provide the devices for vehicles should people be convicted of this and have it as part of their sentencing. As Senator Meyer said, he knows of at least two providers, and those providers had actually had contacted our office when we were in the process of working on this bill, saying, you know, this doesn't work, having the probation and the interlock ignition device tied together, because a lot of people are kind of getting out of it. In other words, they'd either wait out the probation so that they wouldn't have to have it put on, or if the probation was suspended in any way, shape, or form, they wouldn't get the ignition interlock device put on. And so they were contacting our office to say that, you know, that we could be doing a lot more, but it's not happening in the level that it should be being assigned to people. So that was one of the things that we had taken into consideration when we were looking at separating the two.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, could I just ask another one? Two other issues come up to mind. The senators from Anchorage, and so Anchorage is probably the most logistically sound place to do this. Some of the larger cities like Fairbanks might be able to manage very well. But then I've got Glen Allen, Sutton, places that become harder and harder to manage those things. And so both for installation and in management issues, can you help me understand how that works in the more outreaching areas and even into the remote rural areas?
Senator Coghill, through the chair. Yes, I understand, and it's very important to take into account that obviously not everyone would have access to such services, which is why there are exemptions that we have not changed at all that remain in the bill that say that, you know, where it is available.
Okay, so, Mr. Chairman, I understand then the mandate has some discretionary movement to the judge then. All right, so, okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. One last question. When we first passed this bill, the question of cold weather and the operability was a question, and now that we've had this many years under our scrutiny, can you help me understand how that works with these two vendors?
Okay, very good. Yeah, that was a concern again when the bill first started, or when we first introduced it, is how this would work in cold weather. And what we're finding out is that the ignition interlocks that have been court ordered are mostly in Fairbanks. The problem seems to be in the Anchorage area. The judges either don't like ignition interlock or people are getting around it somehow. So from every indication we get, they're working fine in the cold weather, because, like I said, that's where they seem to be the most often used.
Further questions, Senator Coghill?
No, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. And I don't see Mr. Will over here, but I sure would like to hear from them at some point as to what what their perception of the difficulty is. Ms. Marsegan or Senator Meyer, either one can answer my question. And it's about, it looks like Section 2 is sort of the meat of the bill, and you're removing the phrase during the period of probation for each of the different sentences you get for your DWIs. Is it that phrase that's the source of the problem? And maybe you can explain what was happening, how that phrase was being used or allowing people to sort of escape the ignition interlock requirement.
Senator French, that is exactly the sort of pieces of language that Mr. Wolver had called to our office's attention when we were talking about wanting to, decouple the ignition interlock from probation. What would happen is during the period of probation, people would either simply decide not to have a vehicle, which is fine because it meant that they were not on the road, but during the period of probation, there was this sense of if a probationary period was not in place for the allotted amount of time that they would have to have it, then they wouldn't get an ignition interlock device at all, and nor would it be sentenced for them.
Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm glad to see we're doing a decoupling bill that's not as controversial as the other one.
Yeah.
I remember voting on this, thought it was a good bill at the time, and I thought we were voting on a bill that would require this, and so I certainly support this, and I'm glad you're fixing up the situation.
Likewise, yeah.
I'm just stunned that Senator Wilkowski may have stepped out, but Senator Meyer said in his opening statement that of the 3,513 court orders last year requiring ignition interlocks, only 218 were installed. I'm flabbergasted.
Mr. Chairman?
I'm really. Yep. Senator Coghill.
Maybe a context question. I understand some of the judges have been ordering certain types of chemical treatment for those who have had DWIs. Is that something that has been a part of maybe the Anchorage? There's been about four different specialty courts. I wonder if those have fallen into those numbers. Just a question.
Mr. Chairman, we're not sure, you know, why exactly. And Mr. Wolliver probably could.
Mr. Wolliver, just walk in the door. We were just talking about you.
He might be able to shed some light on why this isn't used like we'd like to see it used in Anchorage, because obviously that's where most of the DWIs are. And it could be that maybe they're going to other types of programs. Go ahead.
Ms. Marsigan?
Senator Coghill, through the chair, and one additional thing is that some people do opt to simply not drive, which is fine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, again, all we're trying to do is keep people from not driving while they're drinking. If they opt not to drive at all, that's fine. At least they're not on the roads driving.
Further questions for the bill sponsor? Don't hear or see any. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
We do have a couple of people signed up to testify. Let's start with Chris Sell, the Alaska Peace Officer Association. Welcome to the committee. Put yourself on the record. State your affiliation. If any, we'd be happy to hear your testimony.
Good afternoon. I'm Lieutenant Chris Sell. I'm here representing the Alaska Peace Officers Association. I represent about 900 Alaskans across the state, many of whom are tasked with picking up the pieces after drunk driving accidents. We put the injured on stretchers, we put the dead in body bags, and we walk up to houses to tell families their loved ones aren't coming home. We'd like to do a lot less of that, which is why we're here in support of Senate Bill 239, requiring interlock ignition devices as a mandatory part of DWI sentences. In 2008, the National Highway Transportation Safety Board statistics were that once every 45 minutes, someone in the United States is killed in a drunk driving crash. Any tool that helps law enforcement keep drunk drivers off the road and hold those drivers accountable for their actions is helpful. In particular, law enforcement has an interest on focusing on reforming and deterring those who become hardcore drunk drivers. Those are drivers found driving with a blood alcohol limit around twice the legal limit. A survey of those drivers by a group called the Century Council in 2005 shows the hardcore drunk drivers believe their actions would have been changed if they had more severe penalties for their earlier offenses. 70% of the hardcore drunk drivers surveyed said they believed the requirement for an interlock ignition device would have made a difference in their career of drunk driving. I think that audience would be good people to listen to. The Alaska Peace Officers Association stands in support of this bill. Do we have any questions?
Lieutenant Sell, let me see. I don't see any, but thank you so much for making time to come in and testify. We like hearing from the Peace Officers Association. Next up, David Brower from the Department of Law. Mr. Brower, welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Nice to see you. Please come forward. And you know what to do. Put yourself on the record, and we'd be happy to hear from you.
My name's David Brower, and I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the Department of Law, and I'm actually the Alaska Traffic Safety Resource Prosecutor, and I've been working with this bill along with some others. In particular, the question of the tying this to during the period of probation is a problem when, depending on the sentence, a first DUI person would get 72 hours in jail and be on probation. When I first started, I think a year, probably 2 years now is the norm, and that's plenty of time for them to have an ignition interlock. A person that gets a second DUI has a minimum 20 days. Sometimes those are looked at not as minimums but as the sentence that will be imposed. And it's generally the one that is, and their probation probably would have enough time. Refusals, first two refusals, they're eligible for ignition interlocks. Felons, no felon is eligible for ignition interlock for 10 years at the minimum because their license is revoked for life. Yeah. And they get to review it within 10 years, and then if they get it back, then they can get an ignition interlock. but they can't get one before that. So this every, and I don't know how many felony judgments there are, but every felony judgment has a requirement for ignition interlock, and I venture to say no felony DUI people have ever gotten ignition interlock. And the other part that has already been discussed is about the tying it to probation, but I wrote that down. The reference right now is to AS 1255-102, that ignition the ignition interlock has been around for quite a few years. Subsection R in the DUI statute requires that if you have a .106 or higher, you get an ignition interlock, and that didn't change after this recent bill was passed. That statute referred to Title 12, and I'm maybe getting a little scattered here, but I think all the ignition interlock issues and sentencing issues for DUI should be in Title 28. Hmm. And I think that's what a lot of this bill does. And even with that, when it referred to Title 12, AS 1225-102, the judge could either sentence somebody for as a condition of probation or as a condition of sentence. In this case, it would be a sentence. So if anyone has any questions, I'd be glad to try to answer them.
Mr. Brower, Senator Cockrell, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Probably following up with my question on the number of interlocks. Is it then that the felonies outnumber so many at this point that the 239 some that have been applied fall more within the discretionary movement, or do we now preclude, we have felons outside of the ability to have these, so do those 3,000 some convictions fall in that number, and does that have an impact on how many we can actually order?
Through the chair, Senator Coghill, I imagine felony DUIs are included in that number. That is a big number, and I'm certain the felons don't account for the great disparity. But some of the other issues that were mentioned are people that, if they're on probation for 2 years, they don't want to get an ignition interlock device. The assumption is, well, if I don't want to get an ignition interlock device, I can wait until after my probation is up, and then I can get my license back and drive without an ignition interlock. Under this amendment, once you get your license back, you'd have to have the ignition interlock for a certain period of time. And it's certainly a fallacy to think that people, and I don't think anybody here thinks that people that have revoked licenses don't drive. Most of them do. And repeat drunk drivers, as a general rule, do not have a license, and I think most people with a felony DUI have been driving without a license.
Mr. Chairman, the reason I was asking is the large number that we heard, I just wanted to know how many may not have been mandated because of the fact that it was felony and it was understood that they had no right to drive.
Correct. You're through the chair. I think the way the statute is written now, and it will continue to be written, that everyone has to get that condition. The judge has to put that on the order that you will get an ignition interlock when you regain the privilege to drive. So I don't know with all those, if all the judgments, over 3,000, if those were just judgments that included that wording and people have not yet become eligible for an ignition interlock or a license yet.
Okay. Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering if we have any, the data that we got during the last original bill's hearing a couple of years ago, and the data we've got now is that this really reduces recidivism. And I know it's still pretty early on, but do we have any data on that, on recidivism?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, I don't think we have any Alaska data. Other states have had these in place for a long time. New Mexico has a law recently passed, maybe 2005. There's a study out that doesn't include the new law that does show a lot of a benefit for having this, and most studies show, and I have I looked at a NHTSA publication that included a lot of different things, including ignition interlocks, and one of the things that it said is they while they're on, they work. Once they're gone, the people tend to fall back into the same patterns.
Yeah. Yeah. Just, and I'll just make a request. I remember that data. I remember thinking it was really very impressive. It certainly weighed heavily in my support for the prior bill. I guess I really like the direction that the Judiciary Committee has had in recent years, where we try to base our decisions on evidence, science-based, and mm-hmm. when we have statistics that show we can make huge dents in crime or in recidivism, that those are the directions we head. And so I guess just for the administration, Department of Law, the court system, it would be very interesting, I think, to track this and figure out whether or not this policy is working. I think my guess is it will have huge impacts,
right.
Positive.
Through the chair, thank you. That's something that will be done. And I think this bill doesn't change the current law so much as to kind of clean it up and make it so more people will get ignition interlocks. And just kind of my opinion, I don't know if the department's, but well, New Mexico requires everyone to get them. They have a short, hard suspension for everyone, and they lost federal funding for the first year when they did that. But the federal laws changed, so they don't lose that anymore. So even felony DUIs are required to get ignition interlocks, and they actually have the capability of getting them.
I guess, Mr. Brown, while you're here, I'm still a little puzzled. It's, I guess I had thought, and this is why we have hearings and sort of bear down on the language and the facts, I had thought we had written the law in a way that sort of allowed judges to not impose an ignition interlock as a condition of the sentence, but that's not what I get from Senator Meyer's figure. Senator Meyer tells me that 3,513 times the judge said, you shall have an ignition interlock. And yet there's some disconnect between there and the number installed, and that seems, from what I'm hearing, to be related to the fact that a lot of people are just saying, heck with it, while I'm on probation, I'm just not going to drive. And do we really think that's the case, that 3,300 Alaskans are just sort of waiting out the ignition interlock period? Mm-hmm. Or do you have other...
It doesn't seem reasonable. I don't have any other answer.
you don't have any, you're right. You don't know, but... Yeah, I'm puzzled. And so so I walk through the logic of it again for myself, the court's going to impose a minimum sentence of imprisonment, first DWI, 72 hours in jail. We're going to require the person to use an ignition interlock device after the person regains the privilege, including an unlimited drive, a remote control in 6 months, and impose a fine. And so this is sort of like that hard, not the hard revocation, but the hard imposition. That is, you can't wait out your ignition interlock requirement.
Once you get your, once you regain the
DMV is going to say, when you go back to get your license back, and maybe this is why we need to turn to Carrie Hennings, because I see us losing the hammer of probation over mm-hmm. a person and their ignition interlock requirement,
right.
but that's also allowed them to sort of slide out from underneath it because it was tied to probation. Now we're just going to say, period, when you get your license back, you're going to use an interlock for 6 months. But now I need to know who's going to make sure that happens.
DMV.
Right.
And I did have, the law as it is now is for a first DUI is 1 year, the second one is 2 years, and then 36 months. And there it was changed to 6 months, and I think that would be up to the legislature if they want to actually change that.
Right. I see we've shortened the period somewhat, and I guess that, you know, it's 6 months is still a good long time. I'm not yeah. objecting to that. But let's if anything else from you, Mr. Brower?
I don't.
Okay, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Let's do turn to Carrie Hennings then at DMV. Ms. Hennings, are you on the line?
Yes, I am. Thank you.
Welcome to the committee. Please put yourself on the record. I've got a couple questions for you.
Okay. This is Carrie Hennings with Division of Motor Vehicles.
Ms. Hennings, you've got a copy of the bill in front of you, the backslash. We're working on version S.
Yes, I do, sir.
And can you tell me how you see this playing out? A person is going to, arrested for DWI, pleads guilty or is convicted at trial, does their 72 hours in jail, and then wants to get there, has lost their privilege to drive and now comes back to you. What will you do to make sure they have an ignition interlock, if anything?
DMV's current position won't change. when someone applies for a limited privilege or they come in to regain their privilege and there is an ignition interlock order in place, we require that they provide us proof of installation.
And how will you know if there's an ignition interlock order in place?
That comes in on the DUI judgment we receive, and we annotate the record upon receipt.
So that you're not trusting a person to come in and say, oh, by the way, I lost my license for DWI. You know that independently of their coming to you when or anything they say when they come to the front counter.
That's correct.
And how would you say a person comes to you and says, okay, I want my license back, but I don't have a car. What happens then?
Well, currently what we're doing, when someone comes in for limited privileges, they do need to have a friend's car, a family member's car, some vehicle they can put the interlock device on if they want to get their privilege back.
Right. I mean, I guess most of us figure, you know, it's a person who's going to, you know, have a car and an apartment and everything else, and they're going to, you know, this is the car that's registered to me, and I put the ignition interlock on it, but I imagine there's a fair number of people out there that say, I don't own a car, but I want to have a driver's license for this or that reason, you know, in case I, you know, want to borrow a car or just for ID purposes. And so at that point, you're going to say, fine, but you show me a car that you have control over that's going to have an ignition interlock?
That's correct.
Interesting.
We also have the availability of the identification cards in lieu of a license, you know, if they're not operating.
Sure, and in that case, they could just, they're sort of back in the Kevin Meyer or the Senator Meyer paradigm, which is if they're not driving, that's fine too, and I feel the same way.
Right.
Any other questions for Carrie Hennings with DMV? Don't hear or see any. Thanks so much for being available. And we also have Senator Coghill.
Mr. Chairman, I'm just going to pose a question. You can go on, but maybe the Department of Law, I could see where a challenge might come to a significant other, a spouse, or something like that, that they're being treated unfairly on that. So it'd be interesting to know if there has been any challenges to that. So I just wanted to throw that out because of this testimony.
Thank you. We also have Quinlan Steiner on the line just to answer questions from the Public Defender Agency. I'm just going to solicit questions now for Mr. Steiner. Don't hear or see any. Anyone else here in the room who'd like to testify about Senate Bill 239, ignition interlock. And I did have questions for Mr. Wolliver, but I think they've mostly been answered. Why don't you go ahead and come forward. We'll just get them on the record for the purposes of completeness.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Welcome. Doug Wolliver, Administrative Attorney for the Alaska Court System. I didn't hear the call. I just got out of another hearing, and I just heard that my name was mentioned. So
it was mentioned. It was all in friendly terms, I can assure you, Mr. Wolliver. I guess I was laboring, I think, under the misperception there was some sort of missing link at the courthouse, but I think that's been cleared up. Are you aware of any sort of problem that the court system has with respect to issuing these ignition interlock orders?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not aware of any problems with issuing them. I think we issue quite a few of them, but I know there was. I know the reason for part of the bill is to make some changes. You can't suspend the ignition interlock device. That was, I know it was suspended in some cases, but I'm not aware of a problem, an implementation problem.
Great. I mean, and I guess more globally, any pushback, any complaints, any concerns? I mean, I'm happy to listen to, you know, the judges are the ones who have to sort of live with these laws we implement. This is a particularly, you know, sort of, well, it's like any other sentencing law where we're asking judges to do things and commanding them to do things. Mm-hmm. Any feedback you want to sort of offer to us while you're here?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I know that in some of the rural areas, there is an exception to the law when you live off the road system and you live in a community with that's on DMV's list as being very, very small. But a lot of times in other communities that may be on the road system, and they consider, by the way, the a lot of Southeast communities are not exempt, but the only way to get to the ignition interlock provider is spend a day on the ferry, have it installed, spend the night, and come back again, and you do that once a month. And I know that that's, of course, an expensive proposition. But it's not really a court problem. That's just a complaint that judges hear from people who do this. I'm not aware of implementation problems other than just the practical aspects of a harsh sentence that sometimes it's difficult for people to meet. I have to say I'm stunned that less than 10% of people ordered have them, and I had not. I'm very surprised to hear that.
Big surprise to me too. Yeah. Further questions for Mr. Woolover while he's here. Thanks for being in front of the committee. So last call. Anyone else here in the room who wants to testify on behalf of Senate Bill 239? Anyone else online? Hearing and seeing none, I'm going to go ahead and close public testimony, and we'll hold the bill over just to mull it over until the next hearing, but thanks for your presentation. So that brings us to Senate Bill 284, Campaign Expenditures. And the idea today was to spend some time working on amendments. I had hoped to move the bill out. I just recognized that I think by doing four or five or six amendments, it's unlikely that the bill will move. We'll probably do the amendments, get a CS back, and think about it one more time before we move the bill on. So there's no danger of it leaving the hands of the committee today. But you should have a stack of amendments in front of you. And we will have online John Patasson from the Department of Law, Alpheus Bullard from Ledge Legal, and Holly Hill from APOC to help guide us through the amendment process. And let's just start with a couple of easy ones, and then we can move to the ones that are a little more complex. So we have an amendment, and I'm going to call it amendment number one. The amendment is / A.3. It's by me, A.3. If everybody's got that in front of them, the amendment would propose to insert the word independent and then, on page 2, line 28, and then another phrase after expenditures on page 2. Why don't I go ahead and move the amendment? I'll object to it myself and put the amendment in front of us. So, amendment number 2, again, page 2, line 28, inserts the word independent expenditure in front of the word, inserts the word independent in front of the word, after the word and on page 2, line 28, and then after the word expenditures further along on the same line inserts the word made and contributions received to make it clear that the report has to include not only the money you spend but also the money you've taken in. Any members of the committee have any questions about that amendment? Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe you can explain the rationale. It would seem to me that if an expenditure is being made, regardless of whether it's independent, it would require reporting. But maybe there's some nuance that I'm missing here in the statute.
And why don't we turn to Alpheus Bullard, who you should have attached to that amendment a memorandum he sent to me. Mr. Bullard, you're online?
Good afternoon, Chairman French and members of the committee.
Welcome to the committee. Go ahead and state your name for the record, and we'll go ahead and ask you a couple questions.
My name is Alpheus Bullard, and I'm an attorney with Legislative Affairs, and I'm here at your service this afternoon.
And Mr. Bullard, you sent me a memorandum dated March 12, 2010 about this amendment. Maybe you could just summarize the contents of that memorandum.
Chairman French and members of the committee, in short, right now, 1513040D and E, that are addressed towards expenditures both in the bill before you and in current law are applied under APOC regulation 2AAC 50.336 only to independent expenditures. To respond to Senator Wilkowski, candidates, non-group entities, groups, all their expenditures have to be reported under 1513110. So it has been the practice of the commission to require only independent expenditure reports under these statutory subsections.
Follow-up questions? So just to make it clear, the section we're amending, Section 3, which is Statute 1513-040D, is a reporting requirement that applies only to independent expenditures.
Senator French, that is correct. The other line of the amendment is just to clarify and better describe what that section is doing. And that in sum total is the amendment.
Further questions for the drafter on amendment number one? Hearing and seeing none, I'm going to go ahead at this time and withdraw my objection and ask if there's further objection.
I'll object only for further discussion, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Coghill.
Mr. Chairman, I agree with you on this amendment, so it's not objection for that, but I also drew up an amendment that had some conforming amendments placed on page 6, line 13, 14, and 15, and I'd like to have you consider this as an amendment to your amendment.
Very good. Let's stop. Let's find, and this is /A.7.
Right, dot 7.
Find /A.7, style that amendment number 2, and I don't want to get us in too big of a bind here on our discussion, but I guess I'll just suggest, Senator Coghill, that since the first two lines of your amendment are identical to the first half of my amendment, that we adopt number one, take up number two, and just and we'll work on number two next.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Then I'll remove my objection.
Is there further objection to amendment number one? Hearing and seeing none, amendment number one is adopted. I think this is going to make everybody much happier at the end of the hearing when we try to put these all together.
Yeah.
So amendment number two, as Senator Coghill has pointed out, is designed to do the same thing that amendment number one did, but also to insert the word in a few other locations. So I think my suggestion would be, at this point, Senator Coghill, to consider amending your amendment by essentially removing the first two lines. Those have already been adopted. Does
Thank
that
you.
Make sense?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I'll move amendment number two from lines 4 through 11 on that amendment.
So let's look over and make sure that our trusty court reporters are following. Okay, following us along. Okay, so amendment number two, have you moved the amendment?
I did.
I'll object for the purpose of discussion, and you want to make an amendment to the amendment, which is to?
Mr. Chairman, just to take lines 4 through 11 on this amendment as the amendment, which would delete lines 1 through 3 on that amendment.
Is there any objection to that amendment to amendment number 2? Hearing and seeing none, that's adopted. That brings amendment number 2 back before us. And let's just go to page 6, because that's what this amendment's now aimed at, page 6. And just hang on 1 second, Senator Wilikowski. Page 6, it's lines 13, 14, 15. We're just going to insert independent expenditure. We're going to put the word independent before expenditure and on report. Same thing on line 14. Same thing on line 15. Discussion of the amendment. Senator Wilikowski.
And maybe question just for Mr. Bullard. And I probably should have asked this before, but Mr. Bullard, you drafted this, and I'm guessing that it seems that the intent was the same with Senator Coghill and Senator French, at least regarding page 2, line 28, and that. And in one draft, you had amendment, and then you made changes on line 5 of amendment number 1 to add made and contributions received. And on amendment number 2, you didn't have that language. And I'm just curious if there was a reasoning for that.
Mr. Bullard.
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair. The request for these amendments was slightly different. The second amendment before you, entitled A7, was only to insert the independent language. And I don't think there's any there in the difference between these two amendments.
Okay. Thank you. And then could I ask, I guess, while I were discussing Mr. Bullard, could you just maybe explain to us what these changes on lines 13, 14, and 15 do in amendment number 2? Is this something that sort of tracks amendment number 1?
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair. I wouldn't describe these as substantive legal changes. They're a great aid to the reader that independent expenditure report, that amendment that you first adopted, Amendment 1, the person turning to 1513.110G now is reminded that that report is the independent expenditure report.
Okay, thank you. Very helpful.
Further discussion of Amendment Number 2. Did I object? I will remove my objection to Amendment Number 2. Is there further objection to Amendment Number 2?
Hearing and seeing none, it is adopted. That brings us next to, why don't we take up A.4. We'll call that Amendment Number 3, A.4. I will move it. I will object to it. And for comment, I'll just begin by saying the idea behind this amendment was to make certain that people, meaning individuals, groups, non-groups, and corporations and unions and anybody else making independent expenditures, create a separate bank account for the reception of funds that will be expended in these efforts. The reason I did it was to, frankly, just make it, I think it's easier for everybody to know that you have to have a separate account so that you're not tempted to sort of draw out of a general treasury expenditures for ads, whether TV, radio, or print, and frankly, to make it easier for APOC or anyone else to get a look at the records of the entity person making the expenditures in the event of an alleged violation or something along those lines. So that's the intent behind Amendment Number 3. You'll see attached to it a memorandum from Mr. Bullard. And maybe at this point I would turn to Mr. Bullard to have him sort of walk through his memorandum and convey to us the suggestions he makes in the memo. Mr. Bullard, please.
Senator French, members of the committee, this is a suggestion, and the question which this memo poses might be best taken up with the members of the Alaska Public Offices Commission. And the concern here, or not a concern, but an idea that these statutory sections amended or added by this act work best for the Alaska Public Offices Commission and for people making independent expenditures who will be required to report under the Act, that it might be easier if you turn to page 3 of your bill. As the bill draft reads right now, attached to every independent expenditure report, that person making the independent expenditures has to include information about contributions that person has received to make those independent expenditures, if they have in fact received any contributions. What this memorandum suggests is that this section might be more at home in this amendment, that these be things that would be required to be reported from this political activities fund. This is neither legally required nor constitutionally required. It may be just a more practical and workable solution for both the commission and for those people making independent expenditures.
Mr. Bullard, let me make sure I understand what you're suggesting. You're suggesting that the independent expenditure report referred to in Section 4 sort of be incorporated now into this account of the monies contributed to and spent from the political activities accounts.
Senator French, that's correct. That they would merely have the duty to report when funds were transferred into the account or when funds leave the account, and that they wouldn't have to separately account for contributors on a report of an expenditure. It seems a little bit awkward. I don't know how it would work in practice.
Well, I know just the person to ask, and that's Holly Hill, but let me see if Senator Coghill, he agrees. So, Ms. Hill, are you on the line?
Yes, sir, Senator Fritz, I'm here.
Welcome to the committee. Please put yourself on the record, and we'll walk you through some of the concerns that Mr. Bullard and the committee may have with respect to this political activities account.
Yes, sir. This is Holly Hill, Executive Director of the Alaska Public Officers Commission.
And were you following the discussion regarding Amendment Number 3 and its the way it would integrate with the current reporting requirements as envisioned by the bill?
Senator French, I don't have copies of the amendments. Our AG, John Potassin, may be able to address that question better.
Mr. Potassin, are you on the line?
Can you hear me?
Loud and clear.
Great. With respect to the separate bank account, it doesn't seem that what Mr. Bullard is suggesting is that a corporation cannot make an expenditure using its own coffers, and I think that's what the Supreme Court found abhorrent in the Citizens United case. My understanding is that it's a suggestion that to keep the reporting as clean as possible, that they create another account where all the contributions can come into, including contributions from the corporation's general treasury or labor union or what so be it. Is that an accurate reflection of what the amendments is doing?
Right. It's not restricting where the money comes from. It's simply setting up a place so that APOC or anybody else can sort of go to one location to find out how much money this entity collected and how they spent it.
Yeah, with any law which burdens political speech in this area, it is subject to strict scrutiny. There needs to be a compelling government interest in narrow tailoring. That appears on its face to be narrowly tailored to a government interest, as long as there's not some outright restriction there that the corporation can't be spending its money and being the speaker. I don't really see an issue with that suggestion. So
thank you. So I guess for the time being, I am I'm sensitive to giving Holly Hill an opportunity to see this, take a look at it, and see whether there's a way to sort of integrate Section 4 and what would be a new Section 7. But for the time being, I guess my suggestion is that we include the amendment and then through a CS or through a process of time, give Ms. Hill a chance to see whether there's a way to make this a little bit more of a cohesive whole. But while we're doing it, I just have sort of a general question for anyone online, and that is there any requirement anywhere that that candidates establish political activities accounts? I mean, I think we all do it, but it's just been a curiosity of mine over the last few days as to whether there's something in law that says I have to have a campaign account, or is it just a really good idea? Mr. Bullard, do you know?
Senator French, members of the committee, this seems an ideal question for the Alaska Public Office.
Holly Hill, do you know?
Senator French, I can't put my finger on the statute or reg, but we do advise candidates to keep separate campaign accounts.
Senator Coghill.
It's just that I think we have a requirement that you have to have an account that has the actual name of your campaign and a treasury registered. So I think we do, and I don't know the exact statute either, but that was going to be my input into this, that if it's reasonable that we do it, it's probably reasonable that others in political activity do it. So, but yes, putting your finger on the statute is not something, but we do have to have they actually tell us exactly what we have to have on the account name, and then, of course, the APOC reporting forms that record it.
It's probably buried in reg somewhere. For the time being, we'll get answers to that as we move along. Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Slightly different question. I'm looking at lines 7 and 8, and maybe somebody can explain this because I'm not really getting it. It says, each person other than an individual candidate or non-group entity with an annual operating budget of $250 or less. Is your intent to be or more there?
I get these wrong almost every time I guess, so let's turn to the drafter and make sure we're doing the right thing here. Mr. Bullard, did you follow? Could you hear the question of Senator Wilkowski?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, if I parse this line out, this requirement applies, and then starting on line 7, to each person other than an individual, a candidate, or a non-group entity with an annual operating budget of 250 or less. So all other persons would be required to abide by this requirement.
So if you're an individual candidate or non-group entity with an individual with an operating budget of $250 or less, you're not captured by the requirement to establish a political activity account.
Senator French, that's correct.
I'm still reading it. It is some just really awkward language.
Yeah.
I don't know that there's a better way to write it.
Well, why don't we do this? Why don't we adopt the amendment, and then, as I say, the bill's not leaving committee today, and if a sharper mind or a sharper pen can rephrase that in a way that makes better sense, I'd be thrilled to do so. So with that, I will remove my objection to Amendment Number 3, see if there's further objection to Amendment Number 3. Hearing and seeing none, it is adopted with the caveat that it may get reworked over again as Ms. Hill sees it for the first time and sees how it interacts with Section 4 and whether better way to express who it applies to and who it does not occurs to one of the members. That brings us to Amendment Number 4, which there are two amendments dealing with this. Backslash A.6 is Amendment Number 4. And then we're going to call backslash A.9 Amendment Number 5 because I think they're similar, or at least they're about similar aspects. And this brings us to the portion of the bill that requires disclaimer. We've been talking about disclosure of expenditures. Now we're into disclaimer, that is putting some words in the ad itself that help the viewer or the reader or the listener understand who it is that's speaking to them with regard to elections. So Amendment Number 4, you will see adds on page 5, line 27, it adds the person following the, you would put in the name and city and state of residence or principal place of business as applicable of each of the person's five largest contributors, so as to sort of ground that into some geographic understanding. On line 29, during the 12-month period before the date of the communication, with the words top, and we would delete the words top five contributors. And then section 12 on the next page, the amendment would state that to satisfy the requirements of A2C, the part of the bill we were just discussing, the following statement or statements must be read in a manner that's easily heard or placed in the communication so as to be easily discernible, or in a communication that's transmitted by a method that includes both audio and video, to be in a manner that's easily heard and placed in the communication so as to be easily discernible. The communication was paid for by, and then you have to state the person's name and city and state, principal place of business, and then the top contributors of the entity are, and then so forth. So the idea is to make it both written if necessary and audible if necessary, some signal to the viewer or the listener who's paying for the communication. So I'll move Amendment Number 4, I'll object to it, and then we can discuss it. Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And looking at page 5, lines 27 and 28 of the body of the bill, it talks about five largest contributors under AS 151304OE5, and I don't, the statute book's not back there, so I'm just wondering if Mr. Bullard perhaps could tell us what that section says.
Mr. Bullard.
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, this is a reference to an earlier bill section, section 4 of the bill before you. If you turn to page 3 of that draft and you look at paragraph 5, it is a reference to those contributors.
Okay. And so just hypothetically speaking, let's say you had the a company that was making a contribution, a corporation or union, and so let's say it's the let's say it's Exxon. And I mean, who are their contributors? It's just paid for by Exxon, or do you, would they have to break? I mean, they don't wouldn't have an individual contributors, would they? This is more for groups.
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, if you turn back to page 5 of the bill, on line 28, you'll see the two words, if any. This concern about contributors is more about trade organizations and entities where a number of persons have come together to engage in some sort of advocacy, less so than, say, a major corporation like Exxon.
Okay. Okay, great, thank you.
Okay, I was on the wrong page, if any. Further discussion of amendment number 4.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Coghill.
I was actually concerned about the top 5 contributors, but I didn't quite understand it the way that Mr. Altheus described it. So what I understand then is what you're going to be asking for is the state residence, principal business of each one of those contributors of the top 5 group. Here's what I'm concerned about, Mr. Chairman. I've listened to enough of the pharma ads to know that while they're showing the picture of people having a really nice life, they're telling about how we're going to upchuck and we're going to get nausea. And I'm wondering if we don't create a circumstance here where we're going to give more information than people are willing to handle, and then the very impact of what we're looking for gets diminished. And so I was thinking maybe what we should do is just talk about those who are the principal officers and a statement from the principal officers about that communication, because I'm afraid that what we're going to do here is we're going to have the names and dates of the top 5 it looks to me like, and maybe and I'm open to suggestion, it looks like we might end up having a full 30 seconds worth of this information. So that was my concern about the top 5 contributors. So if I'm wrong on that, I need to know.
As I'm sitting here listening to your comments, I'm thinking along the same lines. This may be something where, you know, we have to go back to our offices with a stopwatch and sort of practice, seeing what's actually going to take to get this information into, say, a 30-second television ad.
And Mr. Chairman, I'm interested in the full disclosure, so don't get me wrong. However, the way I understand what we're going to be requiring in other areas of this, that is going to be probably reportable information that people will get in other venues and may not be well received under this venue because it will be ignored. So that's just something to think about.
I'm sensitive to that. Maybe we should turn to either Mr. Patassin or Mr. Bullard and ask whether, how far you can go in the direction of, let's use the example of a 30-second TV ad, because, obviously I think a newsprint advertisement, you've got some pretty good, it's less burdensome. But in a 30-second TV ad, and I understand this is a hypothetical, but we have to probably discuss it. How far can you go with respect to requiring an audible disclosure before you've sort of infringed too deeply on a corporation's or a union's or a candidate's First Amendment rights? And let's turn to you, Mr. Bullard. Do you want to take a stab at that?
Certainly. Senator French, members of the committee, any burden on speech is going to have to be narrowly tailored to a compelling government interest, most likely in this circumstance. A prohibition, an absolute prohibition, what the court found in Citizens United, that's too burdensome. A limitation, that would be burdensome, but less burdensome than either a prohibition or a limitation is disclosure. Within disclosure, at what point too much disclosure is too much, it's unclear. I don't know if the test is a stopwatch. The test would be that burden, that amount of time, audio time in an advertisement, if that was a concern. It could be just a visual representation, say in a television advertisement, as opposed to both a visual and audio. There might be a number of ways to approach it, but I cannot tell you with any certainty where that line is in this context.
Good answer. Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want the record to be perfectly clear, at least of my intent in this regard, that I do believe this is absolutely a compelling state interest, that we require as much disclosure as absolutely possible. And I, quite frankly, from the state perspective, and for protecting our representative democracy, feel that there is absolute compelling interest in listing at least the top five contributors. I'd go for all of them, quite frankly, but I recognize the top five. There's certainly a compelling interest there, and the name and location. I think there is a compelling state interest there, so I'm inclined to err on the side of more disclosure, because I think big money in elections is dangerous to representative democracy, and I believe there is a compelling state interest in having more disclosure rather than less. So I support your amendment.
Thank you, Senator Wilikowski, and I guess I wouldn't be surprised to see your words in a brief someday. So, and I'm sure some lawyer out there is going to thank you for having uttered them. Mm-hmm. And I thank you as well. I appreciate the comments. Mr. Patasson, do you want to weigh in on this question?
No, and I would echo that thought. As much discussion about compelling government interests here, it certainly helps establish a record for future litigation. And, I mean, we are talking about free speech. These laws are subject to challenge, and I applaud the conversation, that's all.
Yeah, and I will associate myself with the remarks of Senator Wilikowski. I think he's right. This is an area where, you know, the federal government has been operating, you know, sort of with these expenditures, you know, and then stopping them at a certain distance before a primary and a certain distance before a general election. And so they're a little more familiar with them. For the state of Alaska, we've never allowed corporations or unions to participate directly in campaigns for or against candidates. It's a whole new landscape, and I think it's a good idea to start with restrictions as tight as we can get by with, and if a court later on sort of orders us to loosen them, we can deal with that. But from my standpoint, this is a state where, and I'll say it, I've said it before, I'll say it again, three companies pay 90% of the revenue to this state, and they are going to have a profound interest, I'm afraid, in participating directly in elections for the entirely understandable reason of relieving their tax burden. And so I think it's important to have strong laws in place to let people know who it is that's speaking to them for those reasons.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Coghill.
Just to balance that, I understand the need to have tight restrictions, so full disclosure is what I'm also interested in. However, if we're going to have a corporation speaking with a single voice, calling them a person, and asking for the five largest contributors, it might be intrusiveness unless, for example, they're combining several corporate structures to one voice, which may then very well be a problem. Much like we have some prohibitions on candidates combining voices and dollars. So I understand that part, but if we're going to ask for that to be a disclosure on each advertisement that this has been the case, then my suggestion is then we have to go to our candidates and ask them to disclose their top five contributors on a campaign advertisement, which I don't think we want to do. So what I'm saying is there needs to be an equity here, and if we're going to be asking for them to speak with not a single voice but a combined voice of the top five contributors, we might actually be putting a more of a burden on that individual voice than is necessary.
I guess it's a good point, but I guess I'll point out that there's highly different rules that apply to candidates than to corporations making independent expenditures. The top five contributors, most candidates are going to have 20 or 30 top contributors all at the same level, $500, right? That's as high as it gets. Or I guess if you look at two calendar years, it's $1,000, and you stop right there. So I'm not sure how you'd pick the top three or top five. You go off the alphabet or something. But I'll leave that to you if you want to craft an amendment to work that out. Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, and I just want to say also, Mr. Chair, that This is not a problem if you have an individual. You know, we're not stopping any individual corporation or any union from saying anything. What this is really concerned with, quite frankly, is laundering. This is corporations who want to hide behind some other group that is formed, and they have a legal right to do that. But when corporations or unions try to do that, we're saying, you know what? The public deserves to know who's behind that group. It could be not nefarious at all. But the person who's exercising that their right to free speech has that right. And if it's just a singular individual, they don't have these requirements. They don't have to list everyone. But when they all get together. And that's my big concern is hiding behind groups, and you know, because we all hear the groups that are formed every election cycle, and we never know who's behind them, and that's what this is aimed to stop. And there is absolutely a compelling state interest in defining who those top contributors are, so we can curtail that sort of trying really to skirt disclosure.
And Mr. Chairman,
further discussion, Senator Coghill,
and it's a good debate that we have here because. The groups that get together have to report who they're putting together. The 527s have become the issue on the national scale that I think probably both Congress and other places are going to be dealing with. But in Alaska, if you have to talk about investment strategy from a corporation, let's just say you have a publicly traded corporation, that might be a problem. Whereas you have the principal officers who are the main spokesman, I don't have no problem with that. When you come to a nonprofit, then if they get their money from 1,000 people or 100 people or 5 people, the principals should speak for that corporation, and then those who invest in it then get to make the choice whether they want to support that nonprofit anymore. And so that's why I think the principals should be the one that speak for the corporation rather than top 5 contributors.
Good debate. We are getting into a little bit of a time crunch, and I think we're about to lose Senator Wilkowski. So following this good debate on Amendment Number 4, I'm going to remove my objection to Amendment Number 4 and see if there is further objection to it.
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to object only because I really feel very strongly that we need to go in a different direction. I'm sorry.
Fair enough. If the clerk would call the roll.
Senator Wilkowski.
Yes.
Senator McGuire.
Yes.
Senator Coghill.
No.
Senator French.
Yes.
3 yeas, 1 nay.
With that, the amendment carries. And I'll just point out that the House has taken a slightly different view. They've gone with just three, the top 3 contributors, and no city or physical place of address. So I'm sure this is the place where we're going to see a lot of massaging and movement before the bill leaves either body. That brings us to, I think, what I've called Amendment Number 5 by Senator Coghill, A.9. And I think it is, to a large degree, aimed at the section we just adopted.
And Mr. Chairman, I won't propose the amendment because it really was the argument that I was using in trying to defeat Amendment Number 4. So I won't offer the amendment. Maybe I'll come back as we look at the CS and see if I can make another move.
I think that's a wise use of our time, and I thank you very much for that, Senator Coghill. That brings us finally to A.8, which I'll style Amendment Number 6, also by Senator Coghill, and I'll turn to you for the motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move this will be Amendment Number 5, no, 6, right?
6, yes.
Which is A.8 by Bullard, which is page 4, lines 5 through 14, deleting all material, and in Section 7, amending that is not an independent expenditure. And this speaks more to the kind of the positive side than the negative side, as we, you know, we were looking at the language previously. And let me turn there real quick. And I might have to have my chief of staff, Reneva, come up here and help me go through this, since I kind of got so focused on this last one, if you don't mind, Mr. Chairman.
Fair enough. Welcome to the committee. Ms. Moss, nice to see you.
Thank you. Reneva Moss, staffer, Senator Coghill. I knew I'd do that. I spent quite a bit of time on the phone with Altheus yesterday about this section. The way the section was originally written, you have deleted language and then added language. And written this way, this makes it very clear that we're complying with Citizens United and saying that the state of Alaska, the Alaska State Legislature, is only changing statutes to deal with the citizens' decision, which deals with corporations and independent expenditures. It's just clarification language that both Altheus and I thought was much clearer and much better as far as preserving the intent of the decision.
So let me make, let me see, as I had a chance actually to look at most of the other amendments ahead of the hearing, but this is the first time I've had a chance to bear down on this one. Amendment number 6 would, on page 4, lines 5 through 14, delete all material and basically rewrite that section in a sort of a positive rather than a negative way. Is that correct?
Correct.
And then on page 5, lines 3 through 11, would delete that material because I'm assuming you believe that what's been written in on page 5 is now going to be captured in your lines 3 through 11 of amendment number
6. Yes, Mr. Chairman. As a matter of fact, the way the bill was written, in section 7, you deleted language and then reinserted it in section 10.
I see. Mr. Bullard. If you're
Senator there. French, would you like me to speak to the amendment?
Please.
I believe that Reneva has done an excellent job in describing what this amendment does. I'm not sure what positive or negative is, but my concern in trying to follow and capture what Citizens United has opened the state to is that while candidates aren't in the business of making independent expenditures and corporations and labor unions are prohibited from making expenditures on behalf of a candidate under 15-13-08-086, I don't know what direction the law or the statutes will go in the future. And so I wanted to clarify that we haven't allowed corporations or unions to make expenditures on behalf of candidates, that all that we're doing in this bill is allowing them to make independent expenditures. It's in terms of effect and substantive effect at present, I don't know if this change is significant. It has the potential to be so in the future, depending on which direction the statutes go.
And let me just ask you, the registration requirements are still in the, I thought they were going to be deleted, but they're not. The 15-13-050 registration requirements are still present on lines 9 and 10 of the amendment number 6. Further discussion of amendment number 6. I'm going to go ahead and withdraw my objection to it and ask if there's further objection. Hearing and seeing none, amendment number 6 carries. We've run over time. Let me just point out that today in the afternoon we received a letter from Mr. Patasson dated March 9th, 2010. He may have composed it yesterday, but we just got it today. And he has a couple of concerns. I'm going to leave that in the hands of the committee members to read and digest before the next hearing and see whether at that time whether we have any more amendments to address, as I say, those concerns. So thank you all for a good, hard work session. This is not easy sledding, but it's very important. I appreciate your attention and attendance. If there's nothing else to come before the committee, we are adjourned.